suspect that in the end, I will not have a headstone. I do not plan to have a headstone, but I'm fascinated by headstones. When I was a kid, there was this old pre-Revolutionary War chapel called the St. David's Church at Radnor, near my house. It was immortalized in a poem by Longfellow on his travels. And I used to go there and walk around, and it was one of those places where the headstones were 250 years old, and some of them were worn away, and you could only get them by doing a charcoal rubbing and all that kind of stuff. Really interesting stuff that people used to put on their headstones. And the reason I'm thinking about this is because I recently finished a book by Ray Bradbury that I picked up in a used bookstore. There's a new used bookstore near my house. It's so amazing. If you ever come to Cincinnati, you really need to go to Household Books. It's so wonderful. Run by this very, very kind of eccentric and interesting young man who collected all these books, and he's created a beautiful, beautiful place of community and connection. But that is neither here nor there. Actually, it is here, but it is neither there. What is there is I picked up this book by Ray Bradbury there, and I came home and I read it in short order. It was not a long book. And I knew who Ray Bradbury was. I had seen a few movies adapted from his stuff, but I don't think I had ever read anything of his. When I was done this book, I looked him up. And at the end of his Wikipedia page, it showed his gravestone, and it said, Ray Bradbury, author of Fahrenheit 451. That's all they put. That's all he wanted. That was his thing. And if you read the book Fahrenheit 451, you will understand that one good idea, one book like that is enough. And so it's a book about censorship. It's a book about the importance of ideas. It's a book about freedom. It's a book that's so far ahead of its time. It's actually a book about political correctness and wokeness, like, you know, literally written 75 years before any of this stuff even came to the fore. Just a really interesting book. I mean, written in a style, bloviating speeches given by people, like, you know, you could tell it was written in the 50s. Not today, but my gosh, it really has made me think. And so I share that with you because I think what I would like is, one of my hopes would be that maybe if I could get a little bit stronger in some area of my life, it would be so cool if at the end of my life, if I did have a headstone, if you could boil it down to like one thing. That would be a beautiful thought for me. If I did one thing that was so surpassingly me that people were like, yeah, that's all you need to know. And maybe it'd be Bart Campolo, host of Humanize Me. Who knows? I'll tell you what I do know is that if there was ever a perfect guest for who Humanize Me, if there was ever somebody I really think like, I saw some of his research and I looked him up and I listened to a couple of things and I was like, this is the guy. It is Rich Slatcher. And I'm really excited to share this conversation with you. Rich is the Gail M. Williamson Distinguished Professor in Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Georgia in Athens. But another way of introducing Rich is that he is the head of the Close Relationships Laboratory at the University of Georgia, which is kind of him and these graduate students he oversees doing research and publishing stuff about from kind of the health and well-being impacts of people's close relationships from a social psychology perspective. And I'm not gonna read you all of his research and all that stuff, because we talk about it. You're gonna like this conversation about this stuff. But he's focused on smartphones and social media and emerging technologies and how they impact people in their relationships. But he's even more connected, in my mind, to talking about the twin roles of self-disclosure and interpersonal responsiveness, and we will get into that. And it's kind of a shorthand for like the two most important things that any of us can do if we want to feel connected. And you know, this show, among other things, is totally about connection. So anyway, I'm not going to muck it up with a long introduction. I had a really good time talking with Richard, and I think you're going to have a really good time overhearing that conversation. And so with no further ado, this is me and Richard Slatcher talking shop on Humanize Me. Where are you right now? Like, where am I talking to you?
Physically? I'm in Athens, Georgia. Home of the dogs and home of a lot of great bands too, if you're into that.
Yes.
REM, B-52s.
You're dating yourself, man.
Greats. Yeah, I am dating myself.
So
that's for sure.
So when you're in an elevator and somebody says, So what do you do in Athens? What do you tell people you do?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, trying to figure out answers to a lot of the questions that it seems like you're trying to address with your podcast, which is my research really started out really looking at relationships. I was interested in friendships. I had a really rich group of friends in my 20s in Washington, D.C., where I worked for nonprofits before at the age of 30. Starting my PhD down at the University of Texas. But when I got into social psychology, I was really interested in studying friendships. And then that grew to broadly studying relationships, couples, couple friends that people make, parent-child relationships. And then over the last 5 years or so, my emphasis really has even been broader about just social connection. And I think that's been intensified, that interest has been intensified by the pandemic because of the loss of, you know, these so-called loose ties that people have, you know, the interactions at the workplace, the interactions with shopkeepers, things like that, you know?
Yeah.
And so really the emphasis now of my PhD students and me is really on figuring out what leads to social connection and then how that social connection is associated with psychological well-being and physical health as well, but more and more just kind of broadly psychological well-being, you know, including life satisfaction, happiness, meaning in life, all those kinds of aspects of what we think of as well-being.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was looking over your research, your sort of resume of papers and things, half of them I was really interested in, and half of them I wanted to throw out because the ones that were about how connection and social relationships lead to human well-being, I was like, I don't want to hear any more of that because I know that, and so does every lonely person I know. And they, it's like reading articles about how important sleep is, and all these insomniacs are going like, yeah,
I know,
This isn't helping.
Yeah, I get it.
And so, but the other part of it was about, it felt like, it feels like there's part of your research that's about how beneficial relationships are, how central they are to the human experience. And then there's this other half that's like, what are the factors that enable people to build those kind of connections? Is that fair to say that? I mean, I felt like some of the papers, like there was this one about self-disclosure.
Yeah.
And I thought like, you're sort of pitching something here.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an astute observation. I would say in practice, those two things are probably a bit more integrated, you know, to try to figure out the first question, our relationships associated with well-being, you really need to then look at what we call the process, the psychological process. And social psychologists, more than just about anybody in the psychology discipline, are really interested in process. What is it that explains this? And so even if it's not necessarily in the titles of some of my work, almost all of it is really focused on understanding what those mechanisms are that might explain you know, whether or not relationships are happy or sad, or, you know, sexual desire is up or down, and how happy people are, you know. So, like you said, the question has been answered. Like, are relationships important for well-being? Yes. Right. Are they important for health? Yes. So we're really at that, like, well, how and why, you know?
Yeah. It's funny when you talk about that. I had a grad student at USC when I was working there. I had this group called the Secular Student Fellowship, and they would meet for dinner on Sunday nights. Maybe mm-hmm. like 40, 50 people there for dinner, bring their friends and stuff. And it was about building relationships and whatnot. Well, one of the grad students came and he said, you know, I just came across this study that suggests that people disclose more and they talk more and they're more open in candlelight than they are under artificial light.
Exactly.
And so he said, I feel that we should apply this finding and we should have dinner by really? Candlelight one night.
Oh, cool.
So we turned out all the lights and lit candles. And afterwards, people were like, yeah. Yeah, the lighting change.
That's funny.
And you're like, well, every romantic Lothario in the world knows this, right?
Right. Yeah, it's funny. My wife often gives me a hard time about how I like it. It's dark in here today, actually, but that's because it's like pouring raining outside. But like when we have guests over and have like a little dinner party, you know, I definitely like the lights turned down. It's just, I don't know, it's more intimate. You know, I hate harsh lighting, bright lighting. I mean, I love the sun, you know, that's different.
Right.
But
it's
like,
different.
You know, when you're inside and you're, and if you want to foster that sort of connection. Yeah, absolutely. That's cool. They did that.
Yeah. But so it sounds like you've been studying relationships as an amateur before you were 30. Like
for sure.
You were just interested.
For sure. Yeah. But, I mean, people say like, yeah, I mean, like, have you learned a lot about relationships from your research? Well, yes. But a lot of my research stems from that just inherent interest. And my wife has it too. I mean, she jokes that she gives me all of my best ideas. So we spend a lot of time talking about this stuff just because, and we're talking about our own relationship and our relationship with our kids. Do you have kids?
I do. Yeah. And grandkids.
So, you know, you have grandkids. Awesome.
Yeah.
How old are they?
I got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old and a little guy.
That's wonderful. Congratulations. You know, I often say I'm not like an anxious person at all. The only times that I've felt massive anxiety is about parenting.
Yeah.
So we think about parenting all the time and sort of that relationship. You know, that relationship.
How old are your kids?
I have a sophomore at UGA.
Okay.
And then I have a senior in high school, 2 boys.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing as I'm listening to you. It sounds like both you and your wife are relationship prioritizing people.
For sure.
This matters to you. This is interesting to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. All you have to do is look at my Instagram and you'll see. In fact, without derailing your podcast, I teach one of the most fun new thing that I'm doing professionally actually has. Well, it has something to do with relationships, but less so. My background in my 20s when I worked in nonprofits was in the arts. I thought I was going to be an art historian. I knew I was going to be wanted to be a professor, but I thought I was going to be an art historian. And so the University of Georgia has actually a physical campus in the town of Cortona, Italy, which is the town where Under the Tuscan Sun was filmed and the book takes place. Beautiful Tuscan hill town. And so I taught it's an art related course. And so I for the first time went there last summer. I was there for 2 months with my wife. And so I taught a course on the psychology of art. And so there was like because it's a studio art program, they're producing a lot of art, and they have in January every year in Athens, a show of all the previous year's students, and every student gets to send a work back from Italy and present it in this exhibition. And so they have like a little kind of reunion. And so of the 12 or so faculty that were in this program, less than half were actually from UGA. All the others were from professors at like other places. So a bunch of them came in this weekend, and we just had the best time. And And we're incredibly fortunate here in Athens, really, to kind of have found our people too.
Yeah.
And that's hard too. You know, we talk a lot about that, you know, different places. We've lived in a lot of places. We lived in LA. We lived, you know, in Washington, DC, which we loved. We lived in Austin, Texas. We lived for 10 years in Michigan. So, and so much about our happiness in a particular place, there's this great song, actually by the Dave Matthews Band. And one of the lines, it's called The Best of What's Around. And one of the lines is, turns out not where, but who you're with that really matters, right?
Yeah.
And so that was a huge part of the, I mean, it was in Italy, it was beautiful. But the biggest part of that experience was the bonds that we all made together and the students all made. It was life changing.
I listen to you, like a part of me goes like, it's a little bit, it reminds me of basketball in the sense of like, there are these great players like Michael Jordan and, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and they are gifted and they have practiced and they are fabulous and they're not necessarily very good coaches. Because they know how to do it, but knowing how to do it and knowing how to explain to somebody else how to do it sometimes is a different thing. And so what strikes me is like, you're a player, but you're also in your research, you're trying to figure out like, how do I communicate how this thing works?
I think that's a really nice analogy. Yeah.
Continue. And I guess what I'm wondering is, my impression is that one of the things, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but like what got me to you in the first place was this article about couples getting together and the role of self-disclosure in making people feel connected to each other.
Yeah.
And you were sort of like, on the one hand, you're saying like, it's really clear that when couples spend time with other couples, sometimes that builds their couple bond. Like it can be really good for the couple to be out with another couple. Mm-hmm. But you were like, and one of the things that makes that magic happen is high disclosure.
Yes. Yeah.
What are you talking about? When you say high disclosure, what are you talking about?
So high disclosure is just making yourself open and available to others, really. Telling people about your thoughts, your feelings, who you are. It's really, in a nutshell, getting to know another person. I mean, every time we self-disclose, even if it's in our intimate relationships, they're getting to know us a little bit better. And it's social psychologists have known for a long time that self-disclosure is one of the primary things that leads to two people feeling bonded together. And I'm not sure, you know, really how I guess I'm trying to think of the genesis of my own like research world, how my advisor in grad school was really interested in self-disclosure. But I think before that I was interested in it too, but I've kind of stayed interested in it for a long time. I think it's interesting in that particular study and in that line of work where we did the couple friendships. The genesis of it really had nothing to do with self-disclosure and really had little to do with couple friendships. I was really just interested in how, when couples are embedded in a social network, how their broader social network is beneficial for them. So like we explored the idea of like just bringing one other person in and interacting, you know, with a couple, but that might seem kind of weird because like maybe like one person, I don't know, like there could be like some jealousy potentially, like if two people like hit it off or, you know, and it wasn't really about self-disclosure in that I was trying to figure out the answer to the question, are friendships for couples, not other couple friends, but just friendships for couples, be it individuals, groups of friends, whatever, do they have a causal effect on making relationships, couples a little bit more happy? Because there was all this cross-sectional research that basically showed that. Like if you look at what we call experience sampling studies, where you have people answer little short questions 5, 6, 7 times a day, and you ask them what they're doing, they're at their happiest when they, if they are in an intimate relationship, when they are doing things with their intimate partner and their friends together. So this was really about just trying to figure out, is there a causal effect there? And self-disclosure is a great way to foster quick friendships. In fact, that paradigm that we used, which was developed by Art Aaron, who's a pretty well-known social psychologist, studies relationships, was really to just experimentally create the basis for friendships in the lab. And so, and it's really good at that. I've used it in a lot of studies since then. I use it in all my classes. I have one of the days that I introduce the idea of self-disclosure for 45 minutes. And I do this, I've done this in a 300 person class where we have people go through this task, which involves just asking a series of questions that everybody asks each other, starting from sort of gentle self-disclosure, like if you had anyone in the world you could invite as a dinner guest, alive or dead, who might that be? What's a perfect day for you?
Like those New York Times 35 questions for love thing.
That's this. That comes from that. That's this. That literally is the Fast Friends. It was not developed at all. I mean, so there's another example of like, it wasn't developed for that. Like it wasn't this wasn't developed for a couple of friendships. This wasn't developed for people to feel better
romance,
about their partners.
Yeah,
it was developed for friendships. It was just used because this, I forget the woman's name, the journalist who wrote that article, which was like one of the most shared New York Times.
Yeah.
Things from all time. It creates closeness. Even if you're with somebody for a long period of time, you can go through it, but it's really good at getting people to feel close to someone that they've never met before.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting when you say that, because I remember growing up some of the sort of old wives' tales I know it's a politically incorrect term, but some of the—
Is it? I didn't even know that.
It is when you think about it. Yeah.
I guess it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're supposed to call them like folk wisdom. Yeah. But I remember people saying like, listen, the way to make friends is to ask people questions about themselves and show interest in the other person, which sounds good.
Yep.
Yep. But I've seen people do that, and they do that, and they're like a traffic cop pulling you over. They're like, how are you? Where are you going? What's going on with you? And they never tell you anything about themselves.
I know. And that's a delicate balance.
It is a balance, because we're told like, don't talk about yourself too much.
Right. Especially if you live, as you do, sort of on the edge of the Midwest. The Midwesterners, my father grew up in Cleveland.
Don't talk about yourself.
Whole memes about this that we frankly struggled with that a little bit in the Midwest, that it's harder to sort of get people to make themselves a little bit vulnerable. But you notice that when you're in a conversation, and somebody might be asking a lot of questions, and that's great and it's engaging, but then it can kind of get to the point where it's like, okay, I don't want to just keep talking here. We need to have some sort of a dialogue. I appreciate you being interested in what I'm saying, but.
And, you know, like if it's just a list of questions and there's no follow-up question, like I say, like, so how did you get into your research? And you say, well, you know, I had this, you know, experience when I was in Italy. And then I never say like, who are you with in Italy? Or, you know, how long were you in Italy? Like if I just go like, and how many kids do you have? Like if you just keep bouncing ahead.
Right. It suggests lack of interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And you just hit on the other, what I call the other side of the intimacy coin, you know, because self-disclosure is the key thing to, and I use the term intimacy loosely here, just like emotional intimacy, feeling close to another person, not in any
connection.
Sort of, yeah. And so, but the other side of that, is what we call responsiveness. Yeah. How responsive people are to that self-disclosure, because you have to have both of those things to feel close to another person. You need to have that, because that's what leads to the connection. Right. And in fact, we have a whole, one of my favorite papers that's come out of our research group, in recent years, talks about how, phones and social media are really good at playing on these evolved mechanisms for self-disclosure and responsiveness. I mean, essentially every social media is all about social self-disclosure, including Instagram. I mean, I'm posting pictures from the weekend, telling you, showing you what my weekend was like. And so when Facebook introduced the like button, that's when things took off, because it allowed people to be responsive very quickly and in massive numbers. So that's it really why, pulls that's why you since, in.
Yeah. So that's why since Facebook and Instagram came, so many people have such great relationships.
Right. Okay. Right. He said, ironically. Right.
He said, ironically.
So you're exactly leading to my next point, which is that it plays on these mechanisms and it makes us want, I mean, our phones are even responsive, right? They give us notifications and beckon us to respond to them. But what they don't do is even though they're tricking us, they're hijacking these, what we call evolved psychological mechanisms, it doesn't have the benefit of the process that those evolved mechanisms stemmed from. And that is face-to-face interactions in small groups. Two people, three people, four people, not usually bigger than that.
That's where we live.
Yeah. And it's not to say that these bigger, like effective networks and larger networks aren't important, but in terms of that intimacy that we're looking for, in most cases, social media doesn't cut it. It's still fun and it's a way, you know, there's a connection there, but it's not gonna, at least that's what we argue, you know, it's not gonna satisfy those, you know, what Baumeister and Leary, a couple of famous psychologists, called the need to belong.
So do you have, I've been looking for this. Do you have a technical, a really good word to describe like the phenomenon of cell phones and Facebook and all that stuff getting in the way of our relationships? Like, because, you know, sometimes I hear people like, yeah, this is social media. But like, what's the word where you go like, oh man, I'm a victim of, what do you call it?
Yeah. I mean, it kind of depends upon what you're talking about. Like what I'm talking about is really like what we call an evolutionary mismatch, but that's really broad. I mean, you can get really specific and talk about something.
Stay with the evolutionary mismatch just for a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
That we're evolved one way and our technology is
pulling on those, that it's drawing on our, these evolved, you know, things that we have in our brains. But it's not matched up for the goals that those evolved mechanisms developed to satisfy. And that is, you know, to develop trust with another person. Closeness, when, you know, trust was important because if you're in a tribe, you need to be able to trust everybody.
Yeah. It's using something that's supposed to deliver you trust and belonging. And instead it's like selling you.
Yeah.
Ice
I mean, it's
cream.
A way, it's the same way that like cocaine plays on the reward system in the brain, you know, dopamine, in the same way that it's rewarding to do other kinds of activities, sex, eating, spending time with friends.
Right.
Right. So it's tricking us into, you know, into that. But ultimately it's unsatisfying.
Yeah, we're not getting.
And I don't want to overstate the comparison like between drugs and the internet, because I think for as much as I think social media is not going to be helpful necessarily just on average, I also don't think actually on average is going to be all that detrimental. It's just not doing what I want, which is really, you know, true human connection. And so I'm not an alarmist at all. I mean, because I know the data from our own research and like,
so you know,
social media doesn't really have much of an effect overall. Now we're trying to figure out, well, okay, let's look at some more details.
Jonathan, you know, Haidt and his gang are not going to like you.
No, at all.
I've been reading his research.
Well, and Jonathan doesn't really do research in that area. He draws a lot on Jean Twenge's research.
Right, right.
And so actually her closest collaborator is my friend and colleague, Keith Campbell at University of Georgia. I actually haven't even broached this topic with him because they, you know, there are some big online fights about these kinds of issues. And I really try to approach this without hubris, without like wanting, because it's good for my career to have some particular finding. I really, you know, I'm not trying to sound like a Pollyanna, but, or I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna, but we are looking for truth. And if that truth means, if my data suggests that social media doesn't really have an effect on people, good or bad, well, that is what it is. Maybe we're not asking the right questions. And so yeah, Jonathan has definitely bought, he's focused on some particular interesting, you know, lines of research, but they're small, you know, they're big samples, but they're small studies in the realm of the whole universe of studies. Right.
All right. I'm tempted to go there because just, you know, remember I was telling you how when I came out of Christianity and then I went to USC to be the humanist chaplain, I couldn't make a living at it. So it turns out there's no way to make a living as a humanist pastor. Right. Like they just don't have such things. They do like in three right. places. And so I ended up, you know, becoming a therapist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can definitely see that.
Yeah. And that's, and I work with a lot of young people and I work with a lot of lonely people. And that's why the Jonathan Haidt alarmism, like it rings true to me. That alarm bell sure. rings true to me in sure. terms of what I see. Now, granted, I see a sample.
Right. People who are going for help.
Right? Right.
And so you're recognizing that bias, that you're not seeing all the kids that are doing great out there.
But when I was at USC, I saw all the kids that were literally doing great, like by the measures of our society.
Right.
And I met so many young people who were achieving at such a high level, who were so capable and good looking and athletic, and they were having sex every weekend, and they didn't have a single meaningful relationship. Mm. And I mean, I saw that over and over again.
Yeah.
That,
hedonism. That, yeah.
And they wanted relationship. The thing is, the technology enabled them to get laid.
Right.
But it did not teach them how to self-disclose or what's the other word? Be responsive.
Yeah. No,
and so
I mean,
they didn't know how to, and their families hadn't taught them how to do that. Their school system hadn't taught them to, nobody had educated them on how to build a relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of kids who take my, you know, we're close to maxed out at about 300 students who take my relationships class. And I think a lot of them take it because they want to learn stuff. They want to learn how to have good relationships. And there's really nothing professionally that brings me greater joy than a student saying, wow, you know,
this is helping me.
Like this one student was like, this guy actually was like, I'm now like the relationship expert among my friends, you know, like, which was wonderful. So yeah, increasingly, you know, as the process of kind of getting tenure and promotion and all that is more and more distant in the rearview mirror, the impact that I can make through teaching, you know, that class especially, is really important to me.
I would think that class would be the equivalent of the happiness class that they always talk about.
I certainly tried to make, I come back to the theme of this course better be useful to you.
Yeah.
You know, like you're going to maybe almost accidentally learn a lot of things that you can regurgitate back to me on tests, but I really want this to be almost everything you learn about to be both intellectually interesting, but also just really able to enrich your own life. So yeah, it's funny. I taught a much smaller class this semester because sometimes the really large classes can be overwhelming. You know, I tried it. My goal as a teacher is to make big groups seem small, to really try to foster that kind of intimacy by having a give and take with the students. But 300 students can be hard, and it's just exhausting because you can't have an off day when you have 300 people that are staring at you. And so I taught a 60-person class, which was great this past semester, and I really got to know the students better. I tried to learn all of their names. I didn't learn all of them, but I learned a good chunk of them. But I'm now sort of looking forward to getting back, you know, to the bigger classroom because that's fun too. And it is fun to be able to make this sort of, you know, bigger impact. And I do like the challenge of trying to make that seem smaller. And the fast friends is a great way of, you know, things like that to kind of get engagement, you know, going.
So maybe this is an unfair question, but if I take you out of the university and I put you in front of a bunch of middle-aged people who have just lost their faith in Jesus and have lost their community, and they've moved to a new place, or they're in the old place, but they don't know anybody. And they're saying, like, you know, self-disclosure responses is like, what can you help me? What do I do? I'm disconnected. I mean, it feels like it's very easy to go from being very connected, like you and your wife are connected. Then you invite some people over when you're already comfortable because you're with each other. And then, you know, it seems like to them that have, more will be given. But to them that have not, it's really hard to get started. What do you tell people at getting started?
I mean, you know, I guess a lot of thoughts are going through my mind. So, like, part of it, I guess, depends upon the extent of maybe ostracism that they're feeling or experiencing from a religious group. Like, was their entire network, you know, there? Yeah.
Well, what happens a lot of times, to be honest with you, Rich, is that a person maintains a lot of relationships, but the relationships drop down from being intimate, trusting relationships to being something very different. And so, like, I'm still out to lunch with you, but you're trying to work me back into Christianity, and I'm trying, and I'm afraid to tell you what's really going on with me. And so people in the process of deconverting, they learn a lot of bad habits about not self-disclosing.
Right. I mean, I guess I would say, you know, the hardest thing when you're lonely and or depressed is just getting out of bed and doing something, you know. And when you're lonely, like, oftentimes going out and trying to seek social connection just sounds insurmountable and overwhelming. So the first thing I would say is kind of push yourself to get out there and just get outside the house. Because if people are lonely, there's not just the social disconnection, but it's usually associated with depression too. And so you sort of have to be starting to try to treat some of that stuff as well, like maybe going out and exercising. Well, that can be a nice little mood booster. Maybe that gives me the energy then to go out and, you know, have coffee with somebody. You know, and the other thing, getting to something we briefly mentioned earlier on, this book, Bowling Alone by Putnam. You know, we've lost a lot with losing a lot of kind of community organizations. There are still ways to be active in the community. And I would say, try to think about whatever community you're in, about ways you can get active doing things you just want to do. Maybe it's, you know, hey, you know, climbing gym sounds kind of interesting. Maybe I'll try that, and then just you kind of, you know, meet people. You know, maybe it's going to the gym. Maybe it's, you know, doing an exercise class. Like, trying to think about things that you enjoy to do. And here's where the internet is helpful. It can connect you with people who have similar interests. But then you have to meet with those people in real life, IRL.
You have to show up. Yeah.
So, that's why I'm not an anti-technologist. I want us to be realistic about what it does and doesn't do for us. But I think in that regard, it can be beneficial. And then also, and this is a more macro level thing, but I guess think about the community you want to live in. If you have mobility, you know, and you're not happy with your community, you know, there are some other places you might, you know, feel more at home. Not even necessarily going to another state, but, you know, like, when we moved from Michigan to Athens, we really wanted to have more face-to-face human connection. And so we moved to, you know, Athens is a town of about 150,000 people. But there's a proper downtown. And so we wanted to live as close as possible to downtown so we could walk everywhere and get, you know, the activity and fresh air and just kind of bump into people. And so that was a very conscious choice that in no small part was stemming from desire for social connection. I wanted to be able to go out, and I love live music. I wanted to go out and see, you know, indie music that comes to Athens still with great frequency. And I'll now sometimes just go by myself, and, you know, maybe I'll chat with somebody when I'm, you know, at the bar or whatever. You know, I think just kind of throwing yourself out there, but that's easier said than done. So I think finding some activities that you can that can get you there. And it just takes a couple connections usually to lead to bigger connections, to a group of friends, if you're in the right place.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it sounds like you're going to have to somehow somebody's got to clue you in on like this balance of self-disclosure and responsiveness, because
yeah, that's true. Right.
I think everybody knows that.
Everybody knows that. That's true. Yeah. And I think with self-disclosure, there's a balance too, right? Because there's nothing more off-putting than somebody who's like really overly self-disclosing when you first meet them. It's I don't know what warning bells it signals, but it does, right? I mean, the wonderful thing about the fast friends is that it creates the safe environment to self-disclose at high levels really quickly. But you wouldn't like if I asked the questions that you ask in the fast friends, like what's your relationship like with your mother, Bart? You know, or what was your relationship like with your father? You know, that would be like, you know, too personal. So I think that gradual self-disclosure, being a good listener, but then also, you know, being able to slowly sort of let yourself be known to another person. And that's tricky. You know, that involves some social skills. And
did you find that there were like topics or areas of a person's like that have special value? This is a really good thing to share early on because it gives another person a foothold in your life. And this is, have you found anything like that?
No, it's a great question. And I don't know the answer to it. You know, you might be able to do some studies to look at like, which are these questions that, you know, are ones that lead the closest. But my intuition is that it's going to be pretty idiosyncratic that for certain people, you know, one of these questions that are asked or one of these things that are said is going to lead to a connection with this one other person. We're really good at sort of knowing some broad generalities about humans, like that self-disclosure is important for intimacy. We're terrible at trying to figure out if two people are going to connect. I mean, talk to anybody who's a real attraction expert, like Paul Eastwick, Eli Finkel, people like that, who've done a lot of experimental studies, it is like impossible to say, okay, those people are really going to hit it off or not. This is why John Gottman has made tremendous contributions to the field in terms of studying marriage and methodologically for those of us who are research psychologists. But, you know, for one,
and by the way, just like you and I know who Gottman is, but for those
he's a famous marital researcher and has he retired and basically has this program of it's a program that he sells. And he basically says, I can predict, right, with 90% accuracy, whether a couple is going to break up or stay together.
And it's based on him watching, he would get a couple, he would put them in a room.
Yeah.
Talking, arguing about something that wasn't big or talking about something that was a contention between them. And he would just study their faces and the way the language. And he was like, after a half an hour, he got to the point where he was like, okay, it doesn't matter what they're saying. It's the way they're talking.
And all that's important. It's more we're not going to be 90% accurate. Are we going to be better than chance? For sure. Maybe 50%, maybe 60% accurate. But it's just not possible.
Yeah.
I don't want to delve into like sort of the boring statistical reasons, like why, you know, one might extrapolate
right.
That. But you know, I talked about, you know, sort of seeking truth. And again, I have the utmost respect for Gottman's research. But I think once you start a business and your living relies on selling a certain idea, it's harder to be somewhat objective about the research that underlies it, especially if you did the research yourself.
It's so interesting
my broader point is that it's really hard to predict not just when two people are going to divorce, but if they're going to even harder, I think, to connect.
Be friends.
Like we know, you know, people who are self-disclosing, shared interests, but you can try to get as many questionnaires as you want. That get at whatever things you're trying, individual differences between people, you're going to have a terrible time figuring out if two individuals are going to connect.
Unless one of them's the universal donor. you know, which I mean, there are these
everybody likes that everybody likes.
Right.
Exactly.
That's what I mean.
No, exactly. Exactly. And I forget what the term is for that kind of statistically, but it's like, right. There's the dyadic effect that like, what's unique about that. But then you have all of these, like what was the term you just used?
The universal donor.
Yeah, the universal donor. Right. Yeah. Everybody likes that person. They're probably physically very attractive. They're charming. You know, we can think about the politicians that, you know, might be, you know, throughout history or celebrities who have that, you know, Oprah.
Yeah. Or they're able to communicate empathy very quickly.
Totally.
As a therapist, you know, that, I mean, the whole trick is in the first hour that a person walks into your office to try to connect with them in a way that they go like, I feel like I can talk to this person.
And
some people are really good at that and some people aren't, but it doesn't necessarily translate to friendship in the sense of like, just because you can get a lot of people to feel close to you, it doesn't necessarily always translate into like you have friends. You might just have a lot of people that feel close to you.
True. Right. Yeah. I mean, there might not be as much of the give and take. Yeah.
And it's funny, I saw one of your students, I think, had written a paper about that friendships that had unequal amounts, you know, where somebody was giving more and somebody was taking more, she was like, don't knock it. Like, you know, like they're still, and then a lot of times when we perceive ourselves to be in a relationship in which we're giving more, it's because we remember the stuff we give because we gave it. And we tend to see ourselves in a more positive light. And so sometimes it's not as imbalanced as it actually feels to you.
Exactly.
So the couples thing that you sort of stumbled onto, like you're like, that wasn't what we were intending to study, but we did, or like we weren't focused on the couple, but like somehow it sort of emerged this finding that you had that being with other couples strengthens the couples bond.
Correct.
And that sort of, and I sort of intuitively think that sometimes when I'm out with my wife and she's talking to other people, they ask her a question that I have never asked her. And she tells them, and I go like, I didn't know that. Like, you know, and I get a side of her that I haven't gotten before. And that can be exciting. Or sometimes just watching her charm somebody else. I go like,
yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. I think you kind of nailed, what we have speculated about is some of the reasoning behind this, right? It's sort of, you're sort of basking in your partner's reflected glory, right? That when somebody else likes them, you're like, oh yeah, that person is pretty great, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
They're really funny. Yeah.
And it's funny because a lot of times people are worried that if you go out with another couple, that what if my husband likes that woman better? What if he's attracted, you know, like the jealousy factor?
Do you think that's a common concern?
I think people, they worry that they won't, like if we go out with this couple and they're better looking or smarter or sharper than us, that my husband will then look at me or my wife will then look at me and think he's not so much. But that's, you know, I don't actually think that plays out in real life. I think even when,
I mean, my guess is that that depends upon like sort of what the relationship's looking like going in. Like if you feel pretty good about your own relationship, you know, it's like people that have kids thinking it's going to solve their problems, right? Having couple friends isn't going to solve your problems. But if you're in a pretty good relationship, I think hopefully some of that stuff is going to be kept at a minimum. The jealousy.
That is a wise and sad point. Because like, you know, what I'm always looking for is what's the medicine? What's the medicine for loneliness? You know?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's a difficult personality, you know, and that, I mean, you're a therapist, you know, like personality disorders, things that may get in the way of close relationships and lead to loneliness. Those are, you know, so I was thinking about this when you asked, you know, what I would suggest. I would also suggest maybe going to therapy if you can afford it, if you have, you know, health insurance that, you know, allows you to go to therapy just to explore some of these ideas. Like, why is it? Because most people don't know, oh, it's because of my personality that's like turning people off. And I think trying to be really brutally honest with oneself and looking inward at like, if I'm struggling to make friendships, what's going on here? Like, what am I doing wrong? If I'm doing something wrong, you know,
learn to manage what, you know, if I'm fearful, how do I manage that fear?
Yeah. Yeah. Anxiety is a huge part of relationship dysfunction because it leads to us feeling bad about ourselves. And I guess I should say low self-esteem is a real relationship problem. And that's all about sort of anxiety about self-image, you know?
It's so interesting because in all the years I've been doing this podcast and all the years I've been talking to people, I've never once had anybody say or said myself, which is ironic being a therapist, I've never had anybody say like, hey, if you're struggling, if you're feeling lonely, you probably ought to go get some therapy. Which would serve you in a couple of ways. Number one is therapists are good at connecting with people. And I know it's not a friendship and I know it's one, yeah, but like still it's like practice. You feel, this is what it feels like to be in a relationship that's pretty intimate.
Right.
But the other thing is that you might identify, you know, obvious, duh. Like this is kind of an aha moment for me where I'm like, duh, you might figure out what it is that you need to work on or a self, or you might identify a trauma that's been made, keeping you with a low self-esteem and you might process it out and then your self-esteem goes up and then you might do better in this, in the conversation using the 36 questions.
Right. And maybe part of it is kind of fake it till you make it, you know, I mean, just use basic, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, sort of try to change your thoughts about how you're approaching relationships, but then also maybe you've been engaging in these behaviors that are not so good for building relationships. Maybe
it's hard to see that for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard to see. And I think it takes a special therapist. I'm not sure. Cause I know some very difficult people who have been in therapy for a long time. And I'm thinking, I wonder A, how well your therapist knows you, and B, if they're being really honest with you. I'm sure, I mean, like anybody else, therapists want to be liked. Right. And so some of these things are hard news to deliver.
Well, and the other thing is like, and, you know, I don't want to talk out of school, but, you know, I was talking to a guy on the Ohio Board of Counselors, you know, and I asked him, I said, because I went to therapy school late. So I was with all these young people and I was watching, I was going like, I would never send anybody to these people. Half, you know, not all of them, but like there were a number of people that I was like, this person's afraid of conflict. This person, they're not uncomfortable talking about sexuality. Like no.
Yeah.
And I said, what percentage of board certified counselors do you think are competent? Like, would you actually send a loved one to? He's like, 1 out of 5.
Exactly. Right. When you found a good one, hold on. And I love the therapist I've gone to a few times and my kids have gone to this person and he's terrific. And I would recommend him to everybody, but yeah, find out. I mean, if you can find out from somebody who sort of, you know,
this person gets it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's lots of things that need to sort of fall into place correctly if somebody is lonely and also just figure out what the underlying reasons are, you know, so, and therapy, I think can identify that, right?
Yeah. Good therapy.
Good therapy.
Yeah. And so it's not as easy as just going like, just go buy some aspirin,
right?
Like, just go to a therapist. Like it's, but that's still, I've never taken those two parts of life and said, hey, that may be a place where you can get identify and figure out some workarounds for some of the things that are hampering you in relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I think the people that I see, even, you know, loved ones who struggle time in and time out in their relationships, a good number of them don't, not all of them, but a good number of them don't have a lot of self-insight.
Self-awareness.
And so kind of working on that self-insight to try to get to know yourself well first, you know, and that's hard. I mean, it's sort of, you know, two related but different skills, getting to know other people and getting to know yourself because, you know, I try to be honest about my own strengths and weaknesses, at least internally, you know. But it's hard. And I think, you know, people, you know, there's different levels of skills, you know, emotional intelligence is a thing, you know, that it can be built as a skill, but there are individual differences and just, you know, how equipped people are for it.
You know, when you're talking about some of the biases and different things, I was thinking like, I remember hearing this old podcast, Invisibilia, did an episode about scarcity thinking. Mm-hmm. And I just think in this realm, whether it's a couple going out with another couple or an individual in a dyadic relationship, you know, with another person, if somebody shows up with a scarcity, sometimes what happens is that when they finally get access to a relationship with somebody that's is that they reach too far too fast, and mm-hmm. and they blow the connection.
Totally.
They overwhelm it. And mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen that it's funny, like when I think about, I guess this leads me to my next question, which is, what are you working on now? Cause like, I would think every conversation you have, you would identify six things that would be like, that's interesting. I should figure that out. What are you working on?
I mean, right now I mentioned the sort of trying to figure out why people don't hate mask wearing. So that's like something. I'm really interested. My student, Christina Lekfor, has been, we've been batting ideas around for a long time about loose social connections. And so she wrote a really nice review paper on that she's going to be submitting soon for publication on the benefits of interacting with strangers. So there's been some really interesting studies looking at that. And so she tries to synthesize all that, come up with like an overarching framework. So I'm interested broadly, like in that, in trying to figure out, what is it that we get out of our less close relationships?
Yeah,
and the benefits of that, and kind of what we do with that information. And then a related point is something that emerged from the pandemic, from some data I collected. I had a feeling that people would really dislike large Zoom calls during the pandemic, in part because you're not able to, when you're in a big group, you're not able to disclose as much individually, and you're not able to be responded to as much, right? Because you don't know what people, like if it's you and I know you're responding to me, I'm responding to you. So we had these hypotheses about that, but then when we looked at, and we found that the larger the Zoom calls, people dislike them. Extroverts like especially dislike them. But then what we find is that when you look at people's interactions in real life, they always report liking more one-on-one interactions the most, three-person interactions a little bit less, four-person interactions a little bit less. And you kind of go on down and you don't enjoy it as much. You don't, at least these are the feelings that people report.
Right.
And so the question is, if that's the case, and this was true even for extroverts still far prefer one-on-one interactions to parties. So why is it that we want to go to parties, right? They're fun, but like why, if we're looking for social connection, what is it that we get out of them? What do we get out of the, like socially and for our well-being, what do we get out of the larger group interactions? I think that's like kind of somewhat uncharted territory.
Well, that feels to me like parenting, because every study in the world will say that your overall happiness will be reduced if you have children, and it'll stay reduced.
Right. Yeah. I blow that news to my students like second day.
Yeah. And so, and you go like,
and I preface it with, I deeply love my children.
Right.
But
it raises the obvious question.
Yeah.
If it's such a drag, why do people do it? And that's where I like the guy I love is Martin Seligman, the positive psychology
Martin
guy.
Seligman. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I can't even pronounce it, but
no,
I love
it's okay.
Him. Yeah. I love you, but I can't pronounce your name, Martin. but he's sort of like, yeah, your happiness goes down, but your sense of connection and meaning goes way up, and your sense you feel like you matter in the world more, and you have a close relationship. And he's like, we are not just motivated by what makes us happy in the moment. We're motivated by, a sense of accomplishment and a sense of engagement. And, so sometimes thriving and being happy aren't the same thing. And I would submit that as human beings, everybody's like, yeah, I really like my one-on-one relationships best. And I like them when they're in the context of a larger group that makes me feel safe and gives me a sense of collective identity. And, I got to think there's a lot of really good reasons why people like parties.
Yeah. And maybe it's, something you said, I don't know what it was, made me think of this, but like, I always thought the reason, why big Zooms don't work for social connection, in addition to this self-disclosure and responsiveness issue, is that it's kind of artificial. When you're at a party, you're not, it's not like group therapy, right? You're not like 10 people in the round. You're all having little smaller conversations with one another. And so maybe it's that we love having these many dyadic connections to people.
Yeah. Or like it's kind of the emotional orgy where some people are like, it's a turn on to have sex with one person. And I still just want to have sex with one person, but it's a bigger turn on when there's five other people having sex around me. And I get ideas from them and I think, I'll try, and it's a crude analogy, literally.
But it's absolutely spot on.
But I wonder if that's what's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so these are the kind of questions that I'm thinking about a lot. And I'd like to, part of it really depends upon the mix of grad students that I have and what they're interested in. But I try to also select ones that I think, their interests are kind of where, not where I've been, but where I want to be going.
So I'm going to suggest a book to you that I know you've never read in your research. It's the book I recommend the most often about friendship that no academic would ever go near with a 10-foot pole. It's a little folky book that was written 50, 75 years ago by a guy named Alan Loy McGinnis called The Friendship Factor. And it's basically kind of relationships for dummies. And it's kind of a book for people that are wishing that they had more close relationships. The reason why I recommend it to you is just because as I'm listening to you, the thing he says at the beginning of the book is he says the thing that he said, we've all noticed that some people have a lot of relationships and some people don't. Mm-hmm. And he said, In my experience, I've looked at people and tried to figure out like, what is it about the people that have a lot of relationships versus the people that don't? Mm-hmm. And he said, sometimes it's introverts that have a lot of relationships. Sometimes it's extroverts. Like, sometimes it's handsome people. Sometimes it's unattractive people. Sometimes it's smart people. Sometimes it's not that smart people.
That's right.
He's like, the one thing that they all have in common, as far as I can tell, is that they all place a very high priority on their relationships. That they think that about relationships. Sense. They put intentional time into their relationships. They invest thought into relationships.
Yeah.
And I, when I was at USC, I realized how many students that were lonely, that when I talked to them about their priorities or the things, that relationships were not on the list. They just thought, if I'm a good person, if I do well in this, if I'm good at this, if I have good morals, if I have this, that like good relationships would come naturally if you were a good and attractive person.
Right.
And so they thought that the goal was to become super attractive and successful, and then people would be drawn to them and they would have good relationships. And this old folky book was like, no, the thing that people have in common, and I guess I'm finding it in you, as you talk about how you got into this and you and your wife and the conversations you have, is, you've obviously placed a very high priority on relationships. And like on the way home from a party with a lot of people, I bet you guys are talking about.
Oh, for sure. 100%.
What do you think was happening there? I had this conversation. I think I should have said this, but I said that.
No, in fact, the favorite paper that I ever read in grad school was by Dan McAdams, who's a personality psychologist at Northwestern. And it was like a book chapter in an academic book, but it was called The Ride Home. And it was like, it opens with him and his wife talking about this party. And I don't even really remember the point of it, but I love that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what,
that's the image,
what we do. Yeah. And I'm always just doing like in this like fairly new group of friends. It's fascinating. These people that I met in Cortona, Italy, teaching the psychology of art there last summer. Like I've only known them since last summer, but we spent 2 months together all the time. And we all just really like one another. And I'll sometimes be like thinking about what is it that I really like? Like, what is it that really makes me connected to this person? It's often humor. I mean, it's often like, do we kind of crack each other up? And, but it's fun. It's fun to think about, but that makes sense that like, you have to prioritize your relationships in order for them to be successful. You have to first know, that it's important, I guess.
So I always have to tell my clients, like, you think building relationships is a talent that some people have and some people don't. And I'm telling you, it's a craft. And some people are more are more gifted than others, but anybody can get better with this at this with practice. Sure. And study and getting some lessons.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of this is, and it's maybe a different way of saying it. You need the motivation. You have to be motivated. You know, if people want to improve their relationship, if they want to be a better listener, people know usually what it means to be a good listener, but to be motivated to do it is another thing. So you really need to be motivated. And that's the priority that drives that.
And I think that that's the bias of people that are into relationships is that they think, I mean, like, not like I'm just going to, this is like a actual pushback where I go like, I think you're wrong. Yeah. I think that's the bias of people that know about relationships. They go like, people know how to be, they know about active listening. People know. And I go like,
right.
No, people that like basketball know about basketball. And they know about it at such a granular level that they go like, everybody knows that it's 2 points for this shot and 3 points for that.
Right.
And they don't understand, like, if you haven't been introduced to the game or if you haven't had the opportunity to do it, I meet people in my office every day who have never, like, it's never occurred to them to ask a follow-up question. And when I teach them how to do it, they go like, this is amazing. This is incredible. Right. I never thought of that. And wow. So I don't think people, I think that it's, that what happens is that people are motivated not to be lonely, mm-hmm. and they don't know the stuff. And so like the stuff that you take for granted,
yeah.
that people know, I go like, I don't think a lot of them know it. That's why I think like courses, like the one you're teaching or research, like the stuff you're doing, like, I think you're actually helping people know how it works. But like, I think that you're studying at such a high level that you assume that everybody knows the basics. And that's because you've been at such a high level for so long that you have forgotten what it feels like to be a first grader walking into a classroom and nobody's told you that you've what to do.
And
so
yeah.
I really want to encourage you, like, every time you think you've dumbed it down, like, take it one level lower and you'll be hitting where I live.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, the importance of disclosure and responsiveness are two. It's like kind of massive. The 1-2 punch of my class. We come back to it time and time again.
Yeah,
that it's really important, and we try to model it. And yeah.
So when's the book? When do you write that book?
You know, the first of all, I think you need to really feel like you need to write a book, and you need to have it. Like, you know, one of my strengths is also like a weakness when it comes to like writing a book, that I have pretty diverse interests. Like, yeah, we're talking about like a very specific sort of thing, but I'm interested in a lot of things, and you know, trying to figure out like, is there a book that's really like driving me is one thing. And
I've got it for you.
Do you?
Yeah, no, I'm serious. Like, there's bands, there's these indie bands, and some of them form coherent relational structures that endure over generations, and others of them come apart. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's some kind of weird Petri dish of disclosure and responsiveness and relationship.
Yeah. Certainly historically. No. I mean, I feel like there's a book about that, or maybe it was like about a particular band. But yeah, so I mean, it has to be something that like I'm really driven to want to do that. And then the other thing is the incentive structures aren't great, right? You can write a great book, you know, and there are very few yes, I want it to be read. You also want it, you know, to maybe make you a little bit of money. And to put all that work in.
I hear you.
I mean, we've put a lot of work in, you know, papers and things, and those are read by not that many people. But to put the kind of effort in that I've seen it takes and to promote it. And like, I feel like I need to be, if I was hit with a bolt of lightning, you know.
You'd have to be compelled.
Yeah. Like if I were to try to make a big impact, I think I would rather do, honestly, something like, you know, what you do, like some sort of a podcast or something where you can just kind of talk to people
Or like
make a bigger impact, you know, like I'd want to be able to make a bigger impact. I mean, it's obviously nice to be able to like monetize it, but, you know, I'm not sure that's the, you know, unless I really feel like I have a great idea that I think is going to sell, nobody's going to read it. What kind of impact is it going to make? You know, no, and that's really hard for academics. It's hard for anybody, but you know, for academics, you know, there are for every Jonathan Haidt, you know, there are 100, you know, who you've never heard of, right? He's probably, you know, the shining example of somebody who, has, you know, really been commercially
popular, very successful academic, popular.
But I can't think of a single relationship researcher who's actually a researcher who has done that. Like there are books. I don't know if Esther Perel has written popular books, but certainly her TED Talks.
Oh, and she's written hugely popular.
Yeah,
books.
Yeah. Like, but she's a great synthesizer. You know, like. I don't know if I've developed that skill. You know, to be able to really synthesize it and communicate it in a way that she can, or somebody like Malcolm Gladwell can. Or even somebody like Jonathan Haidt does a beautiful job because he's both a researcher and he can do that. Like in a way, Dan Gilbert with his book, Stumbling on Happiness, great book, like hugely commercially successful.
Yeah.
But that's really, you have to be a really, really good writer and you have to have a really coherent, good idea that you can make people want to read about, to read the book, not just the topic.
And people don't read books very much anymore, period. So. You know, now that I'm thinking
about it, that's a challenge too, right?
Yeah. Now that I'm thinking of it, like I'm like that, you know, I'm aging, I'm dating myself because I go like, I'm like, wow, you're studying something that's really important and you're really articulate. And I'm like, yeah, writing a book, that's what I should have said.
TikTok or something. I don't know.
50 years ago, right? Write a book.
That's true too. Yeah. Like, so I don't know. I would love to figure out some ways to be able to disseminate what I know, if it's useful, you know, to the world, but, trying to sit down and really, you know, I mean, I suppose some people just sort of accidentally stumble on it, but I think it probably usually involves a good amount of forethought.
Have you ever heard of William Derisiewicz?
Mm-mm.
He wrote a really famous book about high level research schools called Excellent Sheep about 10 years ago.
Sounds familiar.
It sort of made a stir across academia because the idea was he was an Yale professor and he's like, my students are excellent sheep. They can write a paper. They can take a test. They're smart. They're athletic. They're bright. They can network. And if you ask them and they all go to Harvard and they're going to study English. And by the end of it, they go to work for some high level consulting firm. And if you ask them why they're doing any of it, they couldn't tell you. He said they're sheep. They're like, where's the next test? Where they're like, they take that job because it's a highly competitive job and they're competitive kids, but they have no idea. Like they're not searching for truth. They're not trying to figure out how to make the world a better place. He's like, they're sheep and they don't know why they're doing it. But his second book, the second book I read of his was called, Death of the Artist. And it explained how in a digital economy, the whole nature of making music or art or writing, there are a few big winners and everybody else pays their own way and the platform makes the money.
I mean, you see it here in Athens, some amazing musicians who can make a living doing it. And they're really, really good musicians. But, you know,
they have to hustle.
Yeah, they have to hustle. You know, a lot of them are in food and bev.
Yeah,
you know, as their you know, moonlighting jobs, and it's not easy. You know, that's why it's great to have the security of being a professor. Where I, you know, and I get a tremendous amount of meaning from it. I love being here.
It sounds that way. I guess now that I'm thinking, it's like I want to see the syllabus.
I'm happy to send it to you.
Because the class you're doing, like it seems to me that as a guy who works with people who are struggling, so many times when I'm trying to make them feel better or less, people feel embarrassed. They're ashamed of the fact that they're lonely. They think and what I say to them is like, yeah, well, like you remember when you were in that class in high school about how to build close relationships or that listening, remember that active listening class you took in college? And they're like, no, what are you talking about? I'm like, yeah, there was no class. Right. They taught you a bunch of stuff that you didn't need. And here's the most crucial element of being human. And you got no instruction. Hmm. You got no practical knowledge. And so I guess like, yeah, it feels to me like the course you're teaching maybe
I scale it up or something. I don't know. You know, there are certainly some very talented teachers of this topic, out there. But yeah, but I enjoy it. You know, so if I can scale it up here, you know, if they wanted me to teach a 1,000-person class, I would do it. You know, I mean, I think it's the more people that kind of know the science behind what makes a good relationship, I think the better.
Well, and again, like I think what I would say is like when you're teaching, is it an undergrad course? Yeah,
it is. I teach both. The graduate course is more sort of, you know, preparing people for a research career in this area. Right. And I like them both. They're different.
But when you're teaching, what I would say about teaching undergrads is don't let their SAT scores fool you. In this, a significant proportion of them know nothing.
Would score very low on the relationships SAT.
They have not made, they don't have any relationships that would be of the quality that you would assume. And they don't have lived experiences and they haven't watched their parents. Like you should just survey them at the beginning and say, tell me about your parent, tell me who your parents' three closest friends are.
Hmm.
And what do you think of those relationships? You'd be shocked. Their parents don't have any friends.
Really? One of the more, it reminds me of one of the, I do try to have some like kind of icebreakers where I'm actually collecting data on the first day of class. And one of the things I ask is like, it's anonymous polling. I use like an anonymous polling thing, which I use throughout the semester, non-anonymously to sort of, you know, make sure people are paying attention and stuff. But I use it anonymously to ask, you know, how many friends do you have coming into this class at the first day? Like, do you have in here, you know, 0, 1 to 2, whatever. How many people are you dating in this class? 0, 1, 2 or more. That usually gets a chuckle. And then I ask at the end of the semester the same questions. And it's so cool to see, you know, like really high numbers of people who have made friends
in this class.
So, you know, it can both bring skills and also I hope to build relationships just within the class. It brings me a lot of joy.
Well,
it
brings me a lot of joy to have talked to you. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Yeah, I really enjoyed our conversation too. You never know what you're going to get, you know, with a podcast that you don't listen to. And yes. I would like to start listening to it now. It's been a really enjoyable, thought-provoking conversation.
You're one of the only people I know that is studying the only thing I really care about. So I really appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah,
not just you doing this, but I just appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like doing on an important mission yourself. So.
All right. That was it. That was me and Richard Slatcher. Did you like it? I hope you liked it. If you liked it, if you made it this far and you liked it, you should drop me a note. Just send me a note and tell me, hey, I like that podcast. And you go like, why? Because sometimes it's a lonely business. It's a lonely business here behind the microphone. And whenever I hear from somebody saying like that episode was helpful, or like, gee, I like that, it makes it that much easier to just keep trying to find cool people like Richard Slatcher. It's funny because I sometimes lose my enthusiasm for trying to fight the dreaded scourge of loneliness and disconnection. And then I meet somebody who's in it, who's trying to do it. And I think, no, that's the thing. Go back. Don't lose heart. And so if I sound a little more excited on the other side of that conversation, it is no accident. And I hope that you are a little more excited on the opposite side of this conversation, particularly if you're somebody who needs to, you know, and I push back a little on Richard on the motivation thing.
but as somebody who needs to translate your motivation into action, and that's the hard part. I hope you're a little more inspired too. And I'm promising you, we're going to just keep trying to find ideas and people and stuff and put it out there in a way that will maybe help. Every now and then I hear from somebody who says, I tried this thing that I heard on Humanize Me and it led to me having a closer relationship. I think, this actually works. And I hope it's working for you. And I appreciate you being part of the community. And I'll see you next time on Humanize Me.
This podcast is made possible by supporters of the show on Patreon. Get an exclusive extra episode every month for less than the cost of a cup of coffee at patreon.com/humanizeme. You'll also get a video newsletter from Bart and some extra goodies. Our patrons make this show happen, so please, if you enjoy it, consider joining us. That's patreon.com/humanizeme. Bart's website, where you can contact him, is bartcampolo.org. And this episode is produced by Katie Johnson-Smith, me, John Wright, and Bart Campolo. Hey, you could be larger than life. You could.